This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm talking to Doug Rushkoff about his newest book called Present Shock, When Everything Happens Now. Hi, Doug. How are you?
Hey, pretty good.
So our experience in scheduling this conversation actually is a good starting point for the conversation about the book itself. We both have really busy schedules and constantly, and mostly my fault, I think, but things come up and you're not able to, make a scheduled meeting or scheduled call. Something interrupts. There's always things going on. So I think from the time I started reading this book to now, it's probably been well over 2 months. It might have been three. So my experience of reading the book in some ways reflects your experience in writing it and the concept behind the book itself.
Yeah, but look at the flexibility we were able to bring to bear, though. I mean, if I was, some super famous dude, I feel like you had gotten an interview with Obama or Stephen Colbert or, Hillary Clinton or something, and your cat gets sick. Do you have the flexibility to take the cat to the vet? Do you do the interview? Do you call a neighbor to try to take the cat to the vet in the emergency while you do the interview anyway, while you're worrying about the cat that's now being taken by the neighbor instead of by you? It's interesting. It's like, because you feel you know me on some human level, and because you're able to keep the stakes of the interview and the podcast and book tricks and everything you're doing, you're able to keep the sort of things in perspective, you're able to attend to the real world problem, the real world thing that's happened, and let your digital lifestyle conform to that, which I would argue is a much healthier way to go than to see your Google Calendar as somehow sacred and unchangeable. And if you've got this thing and that person's important and I can't move it, and, well, kitty, you just sort of lie there dying.
That's true. But I think what you're saying is that we are still human. And I think you mentioned this in the book in some ways, although it is a little scary, as you point out, that it isn't technology that does the things to us. It's people's use of technology that we are living in. If people are worried about their privacy or the fact that they're being profiled online constantly, it isn't that technology is doing that to us. It's people using the tool of technology, which in some ways I think is just the way it is. We are still living in a human environment. The technology kind of coexists with us, but it's not a being unto itself.
Right.
Contrary to Kevin Kelly's view, maybe.
I've never really worried about what technology is doing to me. I worry about what a person is doing to me through a technology. I mean, the only time to worry about technologies is when you're using them without understanding the biases of the technology. So if you're using, Google Calendars and things like that without understanding that they tend to make time appear a certain way, or they tend to make the human schedule maybe seem more flexible, or out of any underlying rhythm that somehow, that time is generic. If you schedule your life looking at nothing but the Google Calendar, you're not going to know what's day and night and what season things are, and you'll be kind of out of sync with who you really are.
Oh, that's true. Well, but do you think that, I guess to go to the point of the book, do you think that what is happening today is that people are participating without understanding the effects on their daily lives in the way that they use technology? I think there are two issues. One is that we are slower to adapt to technology Then technology itself moves because we're human scale is different from machine scale. But it seems also that what you're saying here is that a lot of what we see in the world around us is the effect of people's unexamined use or participation in the digital media and technology that marks contemporary life.
Yeah, but it's not just that. It's also our unexplored participation in corporate capitalism and everything else. We don't tend to question the biases of the money we use. I write a lot about that in Present Shock, that what we're doing is taking an industrial age economy and trying to amplify it or reify it through digital technology. And that's a real problem. Digital technology, if anything, it helps to retrieve some of the peer-to-peer value creation and exchange that we all enjoyed long before central currency was invented. Back when people made stuff and exchanged it and had some connection to the value that they were bringing into this world. It was before the industrial age and the invention of the clock and the invention of interest-bearing currency, where people, where time equaled money and people worked on the clock or punched the clock and worked by the hour in a way that was really quite intentionally devised to disconnect them from the value that they brought in that from what they actually made. And now here we are in a digital age. We're able to do, Etsy and Burning Man and peer-to-peer eBay, Bitcoin, favor banks and local currency. We can do whatever the heck we want. We can work at home, in our underwear, in our own time. Yet we're still trying to get jobs. We're still trying to find someone to pay us by the hour to do stuff that nobody even needs in the first place.
Well, no, I thought I'm glad you brought this up because I thought your analysis and explanation of interest in, and because the book is about time, but interest, I had never really thought about the fact that interest requires charging interest on money loaned or invested requires growth. Of course, I mean, if you know that by almost instinct, but the way you described it, I thought really crystallized an idea for me that I hadn't understood fully, and that is this sort of the imperative of growth based on the idea that money is making money.
Right. And that's just exploring the landscape. So in other words, if everybody kind of knows, oh yeah, the economy has to grow because, money's being lent at interest, it has to be paid back more than was lent out, so the economy has to grow, of course. Okay, but that doesn't mean that that doesn't mean reality is that way or that nature's that way. It means that we have a society that's built on top of a very particular kind of currency that has a growth mandate. So rather than accepting that as a given circumstance, we can look at it as
Well, it's as an opportunity to you mentioned in the book also that the Ottoman Empire had a, I mean, because it's a Muslim empire that according to Muslim law, you're not allowed to charge interest on money. So in the Ottoman Empire, they had a zero interest currency and what you call, and I think correctly, a sustainable economy. And there are a lot of people today trying to figure out how will we get out of the growth economy? How do we stop the imperative of continuous growth and look for continuous survivability or continuous sustainability. And it's just interesting to think about it in those terms because it changes your way of understanding where the growth imperative comes from. It's not a given. The world is not about growth. It's humans who have established this hegemony over time.
I mean, in nature, I mean, some things do grow, but then sometimes they also reach full grownness. And what does that mean? Or they grow and they expand and they contract. There's a lot of different opportunities other than just growing, and certainly other than growing at some agreed upon rate of interest. And that's really the problem in business today, is that they're all stuck with their debt structures. They're all stuck having to prove quarter over quarter growth at some certain rate, or small businesses have to pay back their loans at some other rate. And that's just, it's inappropriate, especially as we live in a world where the resources are not infinite, where there's there's limits to what we can do.
Right, whereas one of the great books of the 70s was called Limits to Growth, which people just don't want to accept, because the notion is that if there is, you can only preserve the current status of inequality by constant growth.
Right.
And if you go to a sustainable system, then it challenges naturally the distribution of wealth. So that's where the opposition to sustainability really is born. And you mentioned before the notion of, the web recreating relationships between humans to enable us to interact in non-structured ways. One of the things you talked about in the book was this great company, Valve, that builds video games.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, maybe you could talk about, I was struck by, or just a little bit earlier in the book, you were talking about the Rand Corporation and their modeling of how humans interact with each other. I thought, now there's a really interesting comparative, the Rand hierarchical mistrust model versus the Valve flat total trust model. The empower, the overused word empower, but clearly they believe in essentially an open source business model where humans determine the nature of their business by the nature of their interests and desires.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, the companies out there who pretend to be the most kind of right-wing free market, open competitive landscape, are usually the least competitive, most top-down directed, fearful, authoritarian regimes, depending on, their ability to lobby government, for rules that favor them in the marketplace anyway. Whereas it's the weird little lefty ones, in some sense, that end up being the most free market in the true sense of the word, where employees can pretty much compete with one another to get buy-in from other employees on their ideas, can create their own teams and try to build things out. A company like Valve, and from what I've heard from people who've worked there, it actually is kind of like they describe it in their publicity, the way they try to get new employees with this publicity stuff. But it's a place where people really, where they do that, and I've been working some at this company, Codecademy, which is an online code school. And again, the way it works really is lobbying from the inside. If you get the team kind of believing that the direction you would take things is the one, then you end up head of that committee. you're the one who's pushing it that way. Then, so I do think that there's a good place for this kind of, it's not a free-for-all, but a kind of a competitive, democratic, team-building, bottom-up company.
So do you think, we sort of have gone on to kind of political issues, but I think that's related. The premise of your book is that time is, I don't want to say necessarily this, but that time has collapsed, or narrative has collapsed in the digital world, where, we have a kind of different time horizon than was ever available to humans before. And I think of it as, the amount of freedom accorded to humans by the technology to not spend all of their time on pure survival is kind of the nature of technology. The irony is, of course, it hasn't it hasn't necessarily freed people in any way, as you're talking about. The technology just gets used to fill their time and direct their time in different ways. But one of the things you talked about is this sort of notion of apocalypse that seems to be present in the culture right now. And maybe you could talk a little bit about how that relates maybe to the political as well.
Well, I mean, I think when people are in a state of present shock, which is really the human response to living in a world where everything seems to be happening now, it's very hard for them to have sort of long-term goals. We don't have time to tell stories. We don't. If you're in the present and you experience everything in a presentist fashion, then there's no beginning and end. There's no origins and goals. There's no, a sense of campaign. You don't have these, giant ends justify the means, ideological journeys like we did in the 20th century. You don't march, arm in arm with your eyes on the prize towards the great horizon. Your sense of life is much more immediate, whether that's in the kinds of television and movies you watch, where you're no longer watching for the ending, but kind of watching them and making connections along the way, more in the fashion of The Simpsons, or whether it's politics, where instead of joining some big movement, following some leader like Obama, who will eventually disillusion you one way or the other, you join something like Occupy, where you are kind of less concerned with these long-term goals and more concerned with your immediate process. It was confounding to the news media because occupiers wouldn't say what would make it end. What were they demanding? What's the goal? They wouldn't talk about it that way. Instead, they talked about their process. Or, what we're trying to do here is to reach consensus. And so it was all about the process or the methodology. Because if you can create a world where you're doing things in the way that you want to be doing them, you've kind of done it. You've done it in real time.
Right, so that they're more about, as you, one of the things you mentioned is flow. So there's a kind of the normal sort of the duality of Apollonian and Dionysius through history, flow versus storage. Apollonian is kind of storage, Dionysius is kind of flow. So the Occupy versus the Tea Party, the occupiers are interested in process and communication, ideas, supporting a community, and Tea Partiers are interested in a kind of hierarchical, even though it's supposed to be libertarian, it's still a very directed concept of we want it to be a certain way. We want there to be a structure that allows us to have what we want. And it's kind of individualized in that way. It seems like the web itself supports the notionality of this, the listening as opposed to telling, and cooperate. It is another thing you talked about that I thought was really important, and that is the notion, there is this, the what I would call the old-fashioned idea that people always compete with each other for what's best for themselves, whether it's greed, a la Adam Smith, or as the Rand Corporation was looking at the relationships between superpowers in the Cold War. It's about self-interest and using self-interest as a tool to gain an outcome that is good for everyone. Whereas the web kind of fosters this idea of listening to what people have to say, giving customers power over the company that they're buying from, or employees having power over their daily lives. So, I mean, do you see that, do you feel like the that approach is really actually happening, or do we have any way of knowing where we are? I mean, that's another effect of present shock. When you're in a system and you have no way of knowing where you are in the sort of in the system's growth, in its life, you have no way of placing yourself in time.
Well, yeah, I mean, I feel like most web interfaces, most of the programs out there are attempting to engage with people, in one of our pretty highly defined, industrial age roles. Either we're consumers or we're employees, or I guess at best we're investors. But in any of those, we're not really being related to as people. So you're on Facebook and you're basically, here's your consumer identity and you work on your consumer profile there. And how do you deliver that onto the, the companies that are paying Facebook to understand you as a person? Or you're using this stuff at work, and usually the stuff is about, maximizing your productivity over time for your bosses. And so in school, won't teach kids how to program computers or anything. We'll teach them how to, use Excel or how to use some other office utility. And it's a problem in that it kind of exacerbates these different little roles that we have, rather than inviting us, to engage with the world in a new way. And that's why, while I like the net a lot and I use it for all different things, I'm finding that real life has become a much better place to explore my humanity in a less defined way, to see what it is to engage with people when I'm just a person, when I'm not specifically a consumer or a producer, when I'm this other, just this guy.
Well, in a way, what you're saying, there's a word I heard this over the weekend. I was overhearing a conversation, and somebody was talking about not having or having agency. And in a lot of ways, what you're talking about is needing to have agency over your life in whatever form or place that may be. And doesn't it feel like that's really what people in general are lacking? The agency, the ability, as you said, I actually think that's right. If somebody teaches you how to use software, you don't have agency. You have a tool. If someone teaches you how to program, now you have agency and you're able to be an actor without, I mean, of course, we're all connected to everybody else and we're all connected to the physical environment and the social environment. You're not going to step away from that, but to have agency within that, you need to know how things work.
Well, yeah, I mean, or you've got to be able to really trust whoever it is at the at the layer beneath you
Or above you.
or above you,
You
exactly.
need to know them. I think that's maybe the what you're you know a lot of what you talked about this before that people kind of don't think about the effect of the tools they're using, but they also don't think about the layers of relationships and what they mean because we're all so busy. It's sort of like you find yourself doing this, going onto LinkedIn and seeing, well, where are all those people that I know? And you kind of look for them without thinking, well, why am I doing this? Or going on Facebook and looking at what people are doing, and they're not thinking very much about what they're saying and who they're saying it to. They're just talking.
It is kind of odd, isn't it? I mean, for me, I mean, I guess it's a little bit easier for me because I've always seen these spaces as where I do business. These are my professional spaces. I don't make friends on the internet. I don't interact with my friends there. I mean, every once in a while I'll get an email from somebody, but my real world friendships are, either in person or sometimes on the phone. But I really, I maybe I've just compartmentalized this, to the extreme, but I look at the net as work.
Yeah, well, no, I think that I feel the same way. I think there are a lot of people who are in the same position as you are, or as I am, but there are many, many millions more who are maybe more desultory users and who I don't mean that in a bad way. They're just not necessarily as engaged in the technology. For them, it is more entertainment or participation without necessarily connecting the real world to their virtual world. And I think that's, it's interesting to see how that works. I was thinking about this, one of the notes I made was I'm wondering whether all of this energy and activity is a way of avoiding self-reflection and it's sort of like embracing noise over signal because the signal, which is meaning, is so scary.
Yeah, I mean, there's the big question though, is are we doing these things in order to avoid contemplation and connection and forming, or building a rapport with other people? In other words, do you look at the phone because things have gotten too social or too intimate, and you look at that to avoid the thing, or do the th is the thing programmed in such a way as to prevent us from achieving rapport and connection with other people? In other words, is it somehow to the advantage of the marketplace to prevent us from forming these kinds of connections? So it's almost almost an intentional or embedded agenda to disconnect people from one another in order to promote more use of these devices and, more commodified exchanges that disempower us. So it's hard to know. Or is it that we're just so attracted to these things that it's very easy because they a device or a red flashing light or whatever it is more
Right.
immediately release the endorphins in our brain than a slow, real relationship that requires work that we're that we're naturally drawn to it. So it's hard to know exactly what's the cause and effect here, which is why, the only thing I can do is rather than look for the conspiracy on the other side of it, is to help people reintroduce some human-to-human contact in their lives so at least they can choose whether they want that or not. The folks that I'm kind of criticizing toward the end of the book, the sort of the Kevin Kellys and Ray Kurzweils and Richard Dawkins folks, they seem to be anti-humanist to me. They seem to be very disparaging of the human experience of life and seem to think that humans are, that it's hubris for humans to think that we're special in any way, and that once computers do thinking better than people, that humans can just go by the wayside. And I'm concerned that we not let that happen, partly just selfishly. I'm on Team Human, but partly because I genuinely do believe that humans have a kind of a consciousness and an awareness that our computers don't and won't, and that there are so many aspects of our experience that can't be just so easily imitated by chips.
Right, but yet you resisted the kind of knee-jerk reaction of some critics of technology to say that everything that you see, everything you described in Present Shock is in fact ruining our lives and making humans less than human, and that, I thought you maintained a balance, which is one of the things you stressed in the book. I also think that the one quote I wanted to mention is in the book that I thought was really powerful is that you said when confronting any of the many faces of present shock, it means accepting responsibility and dominion over the moment in which we are living right now. And I thought that was very important that you're not taking the view that technology is destroying human relationships. What you're saying is that we have to be more conscious and aware of our relationships to technologies, our relationships to one another, the relationships that we have to the real world, the physical world, and not only maintain balance, but maintain awareness, self-awareness, of how we interact.
Yeah, I mean, our technologies are offering us a very valuable but a highly skewed representation of what's happening, right now. And there's another now that's going on all around you at all times. So it's it's just something I'm hoping to help bring back into people's consciousness. And I thought the more that we can, sort of successfully delineate between present shock and presentism, between the false now of our devices, our economy, or our culture, and the real now of human beings engaged with one another, the more consciously we will be able to really to operate, to function, and the more we will be able to kind of program our devices and our work lives to conform to our humanity rather than the other way around.
I think that's good. Well, listen, I know you have to go, and I wanted to thank you for spending this time talking about your book. I like this book. I think it's worth the time that readers are going to put into it. It's worth the time that you spent writing it. So we appreciate that. I've been talking to Doug Rushkoff about his new book, Present Shock, When Everything Happens Now. Doug, it's been great talking to you. Thanks.
Great talking to you too. Let's do it again.
All right. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Thank you very much.